seeing that, or those who are guiding should be very, very careful to see that what is the limit that someone can do something out of their nature. Like that. So then we can see here, then ultimately the performance that gladdens the heart, the real thing is chanting the holy name, performing devotional activities. These are the real things. So if one finds that the chanting and all that is the main thing that gladdens the heart, that should be the main thrust of one's activity. Right? If one finds it does at some points, but then there's a lot of time where it's not, then one should find those activities of sadhana that gladden the heart and concentrate on those. And then if that takes up some of, you know, more of our day, but there's still time left, then you should fill that up with the activities according to Dvarna and Ashram. Then this way it goes. But the first preference is to always those things that actually gladden the heart, which is the spiritual activities. Okay. 162. Let him never offend the teacher who initiated him, nor him who explained the Veda, nor his father and mother, nor any other guru, nor cows, nor brahmanas, nor any men performing austerities. You know, all these personalities are to be respected. We've gained something from them, right? The person who's initiated, then we have a debt to them because of that connection that they've given us to the Veda, to the you know, in the Vedic system, to the knowledge of the Veda, like that right to study, or to those who give the Pancharatrik Diksha, like that. Then nor to him who explained the Veda, in other words, the Siksha Guru, the one who describes in these things, because it's by that knowledge of the Veda we're actually able to elevate ourselves. When we have transcendental knowledge, then combine that with the activities, that gives us realization. So that is our elevation, that knowledge. The right to go deeply, seriously into this knowledge that Krishna accepts us, then that is that person, that teacher. Right? It's called a teacher. See, the Vedic concept, there's no such thing as just diksha. It always means siksha is there. But here it means the siksha, the teacher who initiated him. In other words, the siksha guru who gave diksha. It's very important to understand this. And then, nor him who explained the Veda. So that teacher who just gave siksha. So both those. There's no such thing. The Veda concept, there's no such thing as just like this. Neither in the Pancharatra. The Pancharatra, the rules are there so that you could be taught. You know? The Vedic thing is even more light on the diksha. That it's someone gives Upanayanam, it's actually Siksha Guru gives. He's not called a Diksha Guru. He's still the Siksha. Upanayanam is still an activity of the Siksha Guru. The Pancharatrik Diksha, that is an activity of the Diksha as such. And they'll call it Diksha. Because one is then Dvija. That's why Prabhupada says real initiation. The Vedic is then just on that platform of knowledge. Doesn't connect one through the deity worship and these things like this. So then, how do you say? Because then you're taking up the sadhana of devotional service. Because the Vedic, you're learning the knowledge, but you may not be doing devotional service. Right? We see the thread through here is that there's always the devotional aspect is there. But one can also follow the Vedic knowledge and Vedic culture for material purpose. And most do. So that's why it's, even though those who actually know, they approach someone who is advanced in spiritual knowledge, take the instruction from them. They take Upanayana from them, instruction from them, only for the purpose of going back to Godhead. But we see that's very rare, very few. But the Pancharatra means that it's only for that purpose of going back to Godhead. Like that. So this means that this initiation has the proper understanding. While the other, it's just to gain the knowledge how I may be able to perform my material duties. So it's. But so that's one aspect, but on the difference between the two, why in this age then the Pancharatra is higher than the Vedic. So then, Then the aspect of the instruction. Then the father and mother, because they instruct us, they care for us, they nourish us. But here it may be the instruction is there, but then there's the material nourishment. While the others, then there's the nourishment with knowledge, nourishment with the training, with that, with the culture. Or any other guru, you know, who teaches one anything, you know. Even one learns something from somebody, learns music from somebody, he must be respected. One can't disrespect. One may have gotten all one can from them. You can never disrespect. You know, they can't teach you anymore. You go to someone who can teach more. You can't disrespect. This is a, how you say, uncultured idea, is that when I've gotten what I can from somebody, then I don't have to respect them or regard them anymore. I discard them. Then this is not because you've gained that much, you know. Because the point is ultimately, yeah, okay. So then, nor cows, is their mother, Brahmins, because in general they're giving knowledge, you know. Just like all women are respected because they're mother, so all Brahmins are respected because they're teacher. They may not be our teacher, but somebody's teacher, you know, like that. So they always must be respected. Plus, they'll be very dear to the Lord. Nor any men performing austerities. When they're performing proper austerities, then that's beneficial even for the area, the place. So we're getting benefit from them. Like, if devotees are in a city and they're performing Harinam Sankirtan, if things are going nice in the city, it's because they're doing the Harinam. The whole city gets the benefit. Like that. The whole city gets the benefit. So if anybody's doing good work, then more than just them benefit, because it creates a nice atmosphere. So those who are doing austerities, then benefits are coming to others. So, and these austerities then are based on the Vedas. This is not talking about people who are doing something improper, you know, improperly doing austerities, you know. Same time as another aspect is, it's like someone who's doing austerities means they gain some power. And so if you disrespect them, you know, they may turn you into a frog or something, you know. So one has to be careful. 163, let him avoid atheism. Is a good one. Caviling at the Vedas. You know caviling? Huh? That's some great, you know, antiquated English in here. Contempt of the gods. Hatred, want of modesty, pride, anger, and harshness. So these, anyone who's very serious about the brahminical duties, then must avoid these. Atheism, one must always, otherwise one is not really a Brahmin. One actually becomes a Brahmin when he understands his relationship with the Lord. Then when he's speaking against the Vedas or doubting the Vedas, they're the source of knowledge. This is where the knowledge is coming from. Veda means knowledge. So if one speaks badly against the Vedas, then from the Vedic side there's problem, and even from the Pancharatric side, because the Pancharatra is called Agama, or that which comes from. So the Veda is there, so the books from the Veda, you get the Pancharatra. And the holy name doesn't take very kindly if one blasphemies the Vedic literatures or literatures in pursuance of the Vedic version. So it's not a recommended process. Contempt of the gods, because the gods, here we see there's a difference, atheism and the gods, right? So we see the underlying, even though it's just seems to be talking in general, still the point is that the understanding of the Supreme Lord is the central feature of the book. So shouldn't be an atheist, and he can't speak or feel badly towards the demigods. You know, because they're all doing work for Krishna. They're serving Krishna. They're devotees. But it's just that they are, you know, their platform is on a lower level, you know, than the Lord. But because one worships the Lord, one cannot speak badly. Or what, even though one is very big and powerful, he should not speak badly about the demigods. Hatred, because hatred comes from attachment. You have something and you can't get it. Someone else has it, someone gets in your way of getting it. So when there's material desire, then one has to be careful that hatred doesn't come up. Hatred comes for anything that stops that fulfillment of the desire. So if the hatred is there, that means there's too much desire, too much material desire. So if one finds hatred, then one should look, where is that hatred, and then look, what is it that creates that hatred? Someone, you don't like a situation or like a person, then there must be some reason for that. So that then comes back, okay, this person did this, or what? So he did this, so what did that do? Well, that stopped me from getting a particular thing. So that means our attachment for that is too much. Because of that, we hate. Otherwise, we would see that it's the Lord's arrangement. This person may have been the instrument, but you can't complain about the instrument. Right? It means they, for being an instrument, they may get their bad reaction. But one has to know that whatever we receive, then it's coming due to something that we've done in the past. That's how we'll look. So therefore, we don't hate. Because if we hate, then it only will increase our desires, focus on the attention, takes our mind off the Lord. Right? It does not mean that we don't, if there is wrong, that we don't strongly react to that in the way of doing something practical to alleviate that. But we cannot hate like that, because you can only have hate if there's attachment. Everything's balanced. Right? You can only have so much material enjoyment if there's some austerity or material suffering. You don't get one or the other. I mean, big on one side without the other. We may not see it in this life. We may see it's overbalanced. But in previous life we've had. Like we gave the example, in previous life we may have had so much money and we didn't take care of it, we wasted it. Then in this life we may find ourselves to be very poor. So we may just see, well, I'm only getting this side, it's very extreme. But if we see the big picture, then we understand that it's balanced. How much I created trouble previously, to that degree I'm receiving the opposite reaction now. Right? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Right? Isn't that Newton's law? So it's like that. It's just like if you have a big, big feast, so much enjoyment is there, but there's also an equal amount of discomfort also. You enjoy eating more, but then there's so much discomfort from that afterwards. They're balanced. You eat simple and eat little, minimal enjoyment, minimal suffering. You know, you eat more lavishly and all this, you know, then the difficulties are also expanded. They are also more lavish, like that. So, therefore, hatred is avoided, because hatred then is a sign of intense desire. Right? Peacefulness comes when there's no desire. Krishna makes that point in the Gita. You become peaceful when you give up material desire, because then there's nothing to be gained, nothing to be lost. You do something, work for something, and then you lose it all. It was Krishna's anyway. Let's say I do some work, I do some preaching, and that gives some good result, and that with that then you build up something, and then somehow or another that's all lost. Now I can get very bent out of shape. That's if I think it's mine. But if I've done the service for Krishna, it's Krishna's. So if Krishna wants it to be lost or this or that, what do we care? Like examples that, you know, you have wonderful temple, Govindaji, right? That was being built, but it wasn't for Rupa Goswami, desired it or needed it or anything. You know, he was happy under his various trees, like that. He was satisfied. But it was for to engage Man Singh. Because he was, you know, big commander-in-chief, he was very, you know, money and influence and all that. So if he didn't do that kind of activities, how would he engage himself? He couldn't engage himself. Right? How would he do service? He couldn't sit down and do bhajan like Rupa Goswami. You know, he's a big person. Therefore, he was engaged by Rupa Goswami. And then it was built, magnificent temple. Most magnificent temple. And then after a few years, Krishna had it removed. Yeah. Rupa Goswami is not disturbed. Like that. Govindaji moved to Jaipur, where he lives in a very simple temple. I mean, exceedingly simple temple. you know, like that. Something similar to, you know, Radha Damodar, just a little bigger. You know, it's not a massive temple. It's like that. So the point that something is done, and then afterwards, if there's attachment because of that, then that's not good. Then that shows that we're not doing that how much we're doing for Krishna is less. There's something missing there. So, I mean, something lacking. It's not complete, our giving to Krishna. Otherwise, you do something for Krishna, Krishna takes it away. Okay, it's up to Krishna. He has his plan. Like that. It doesn't mean we just let things just disappear. We take care of Krishna's interest. But when we see, despite that taking care, still things just go in some, you know, and others tell us, no, don't be attached, do this, that, then one could see the writing. Then want of modesty, you know, he's too proud of what he does, you know, because when one's proud, well, then there's a tendency to not perform duties properly, you know, like that. Because when there's modesty, then one's always willing and able to do one's service, one's activities. When one becomes proud, then all the little things one doesn't care for anymore. Like that. So that means his quality of service will go down. No one appreciates the pride. Something well done in a humble way is very much appreciated. And something done in a very proud way, then... Okay, if it's very great, people understand it, but it's not well... appreciated. It's not well appreciated. Then the pride there, anger, because anger comes after, if there's hatred, then there's desire, then after comes anger. Harshness, you know, comes from pride. So these are all things one has to look out for. 164, let him, when angry, not raise a stick against another man, nor strike anyone except a son or a pupil. Those two he may punish in order to correct them. Yeah. In other words, those who are under one's care only means that one is giving shelter to, they can be punished. If not, they can't be punished. Like that. Unless you're giving shelter, then you can't punish the person. Huh? Is he?
He's asking if he's one of his men.
Could you like that? Gute. Someone else's name.
Can I take him to the one day?
Yeah. I don't know. He's here.
Yeah, I don't know.
Here? Oh, okay. No, Vamande doesn't watch the pictures, does
he? I think it's his guy.
Oh, okay. If he just wants to talk, he should come. He'll come back tomorrow or something. 165. A twice-born man who has merely threatened a Brahmin with the intention of doing him a corporal injury will wander about for 100 years in the Tamisra hell. You know Tamisra? Not sure which one's Tamisra.
It's one of the ones in the fifth canton.
Oh, yeah. I'm just wondering which one, you know. Which one?
One of the original four.
It's one of the original four.
That's created by Brahma, or that's created by Vishnu. As the four illusions, the four original hellish situations, because the material world cannot be without illusions, so before Lord Brahma is created, four illusory hellish concepts are created. There's Tamishra, Andhra-Tamishra, five, Moha, Maha, Moha, or something else. This is one of the first five.
Oh, yeah, I think fear of death is also that one, whatever that's called. Oh, I see, and that translates into a hell. So, yeah, so this is ignorance, because anger comes from ignorance. So it's, I guess, natural. Yeah, so especially, it says here, one should not strike anybody. And then here, then it especially is pointing out, and amongst anybody, especially not a Brahmin. Like that. 166, having intentionally struck him in anger, even with a blade of grass, he would be born during 21 existences in the wombs of such beings, where men are born in punishment of their sins. Like that. So one will... So don't even throw a blade of grass. Don't even strike a Brahmin with a blade of grass. You know? So one may say, we're devotees, these things don't matter. But the point is Brahmins are dear to Krishna, and Krishna has made these rules. So this is what Krishna thinks about it. So maybe one may not spend 21 existences like this, but one may run the risk of losing one's taste for the devotional process and going away. Like that. So, you know, one may think, well, that's not so bad, you know, but that's the worst. Better 21 existences where there's some problem, you know, some reactions, than to lose one's Krishna consciousness. 167. The man who in his folly caused blood to flow from the body of a brahmana who does not attack him will suffer after death exceedingly great pain. As many particles of dust as the blood takes up from the ground, during so many years the spiller of the blood will be devoured by other animals in the next world.
You're making that point about that we're devotees. And Raghunath Das Goswami, in the first verse of Manashiksha, offers obeisances to the spiritual master, the residents of Vrindavan, the place, Vrindavan itself. Then, what's the other thing? Sujane.
Speak a little louder.
To the Vaishnavas. And then Bhusuragane, those who are gods on earth, the Brahmins.
Oh.
And then to his mantra, Diksha mantra.
Mm.
And then to the holy name. And then Radha and Krishna.
Mm.
And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur comments that those Bhusuragane, they are Kanishthas.
Bhusuraganes are Kanishthas.
Yeah,
because when the Brahman understands the purpose, then they become then more advanced, then they start to actually dynamically deal with their knowledge. The whole, the Brahman, the go Brahmana Hitaya Cha, you know, though they're in second place after the cows. Brahmins are very dear. We see them also in Vrindavan. In the morning when Radha and Krishna wake up, then the Brahmins are already up performing, chanting Vedic mantras and performing yajnas and Krishna's, you know, birth ceremony and the festival in Vrindavan, and, you know, the Brahmins are coming chanting mantras. You always hear, whenever there's a festival like that, then there's always Brahmins are chanting Vedic mantras, and then the Sankirtan's going on and other things like that. So the Brahmins are very, cannot be disrespected. I think when some devotee is discussing with Prabhupada and in a morning walk or something, and then point came up about Brahmins, and the devotee was kind of making the point that, you know, we're the only Brahmins, and then Prabhupada made the point, no, you know, India there's also people who are Brahmins, you know, by nature or not. So that always has to be respected. Just like Prabhupada would have bona fide sannyasi, even if they were Mayavadis, still we had to offer obeisances, because we were respecting the order, and they were following the order, you know, so then that had to be respected. So Brahmins, even if they're not, you know, within our society, they must be respected, because they're doing their duties and they have those qualities. So those qualities are qualities of Krishna. You know, their knowledge, their following of the duties, these come from Krishna. You know, renunciation comes from Krishna. You know, the monarch and other powerful people are respected because that comes from Krishna. You know, people are famous, we respect that, it's coming from Krishna. Are wealthy, we respect that, it's coming from Krishna. So, in other words, one starts to see all these duties because everything's actually coming from Krishna. You know, it's one starts to see this is just, you don't see Krishna everywhere by just the Bhagavat understanding and the Leela. And then, so then one can see according to the ritual, you know, is this favorable, not favorable for the performance of the deity worship and such activities, you know, is it clean, not clean, and all these things. And then just all the different potencies of the Lord are there in the activities that one can see in just the nature, the culture and nature around that's coming from the Vedic literatures like that. So in this way one can see Krishna everywhere. A wise man should therefore never threaten a Brahmin, nor strike him even with a blade of grass, nor cause his blood to flow. Neither a man who lives unrighteously, nor he who acquires wealth by telling falsehoods, nor he who always delights in doing injury, ever attain happiness in this world. Let him, though suffering in consequence of his righteousness, never turn his heart to unrighteousness, for he will see the speedy overthrow of unrighteous, wicked men. So, unrighteousness practiced in this world does not at once produce its fruit, like a cow, but advancing slowly, it cuts off the root of him who committed it. If the punishment falls not on the offender himself, it falls on his sons. If not on the sons, at least on his grandsons. But an antiquity once committed, or iniquity once committed, never fails to produce fruit to him who has wrought it. He prospers for a while, though unrighteousness, through unrighteousness, then he gains great good fortune. Next he conquers his enemies, but at last he perishes, branch and root. So someone may perform unrighteous activities from that gain and benefit. We may see, oh, they're really rich, powerful, and so many things, and how can they do? But they will eventually be destroyed. It's not that there'll be a little problem, there'll be very severe reaction like that. So if you don't see it happen to him in this life, you'll see it happen to the children, grandchildren. In other words, that whole dynasty will just be wiped out. Unrighteous activities will destroy the whole dynasty. So therefore, those who are suffering through the consequence of unrighteousness should never turn themselves to unrighteousness, because then they'll also be destroyed. One should always continue to properly perform one's activities in the proper way. Right? Because sometimes it's seen, how do they get away with it? But they're only getting away for a short time. Right? The fruits are coming quickly, the reaction is coming quickly. While the other fruits may seem slow. Because it takes a while. You have to arrange the situation. Right? You want to punish somebody, you have to have the right situation to do that. So the material nature is creating that situation and giving them the opportunity, because they have that desire to fulfill those desires. They want to be a big person and do unrighteous activities and get so much benefit. Material nature gives them that. But then from that, they'll suffer so much. Great suffering. 175. Let him always delight in truthfulness, obedience to the sacred law, conduct worthy of an Aryan, and purity. Let him chastise his pupils according to the sacred law. Let him keep his speech, his arms, and his belly under control. Okay, so one should always be, that truthfulness, doing what is proper, then following the scriptures, and then conduct worthy of someone who is following the scriptures, you know. Then for a devotee, means conduct worthy of a devotee, the Vaishnava etiquette. And then chastising someone, the pupils, it says, means here, it was don't chastise anybody. And the only ones that can be chastised are students and sons. So, but that still should be according to the sacred law. There's still rules on that. You can't just do anything. You still have to behave properly in that chastisement. Because the purpose of the chastisement is someone must learn from it. They must gain from it. They must be able to correct themselves from it. Point is we are doing something wrong, and the teacher desires that we don't do that wrong. So then some chastisement or punishment is given with the idea is that then it will be understood what's wrong and will correct that bad habit. But just to punish just because they've done something wrong, you don't like it, and you want them to suffer, that has nothing to do with reality. That goes back to hatred. So that is avoided. Pride, hatred, that doesn't there. The point is that these things are given for the purpose that they will understand what they've done and try to correct it. Like that. That's the purpose. The reason that it's only the son's pupils like that is because they will listen. That's what it means, relationship means. Someone else, you may have good counsel to give, but if they're not interested to take it, why will give it? They won't listen. But the students and all that means that they should take it. They're good students. And if they're not, then that's another thing. Let him avoid the acquisition of wealth and the gratification of his desires if they are opposed to the sacred law, and even lawful acts which may cause pain in the future or are offensive to men. Means lawful acts means according to the scriptures, but they're going to disturb other people. Then even that he should not do. You know, for acquisition of wealth and gratification of desires. You know, one may do things according to the rules, but if it disturbs others, then that's not good. You know, that means one hasn't understood the whole situation that one is in. Yeah. So therefore you can't use it against somebody. Like sometimes you see devotees will pull out a scriptural quote to create a situation in which they feel they are the gainer, you know? The manager or someone in the position or some way, something is gained from that. Here it says, wealth, desires, whatever it is. You may be using the scriptures to get that, but if the other person is very, very dissatisfied with that, then that's not good, you know? That's not good. So there's also the one is that the person who is disturbed, it also should be that they're someone who follows the rules also. That's one aspect. Because someone who doesn't follow the rules, doesn't matter what you do, they'll never be satisfied. And like for a criminal, you do anything, they're not going to be satisfied unless you let them just do what they want to do. So that also is there. You know? That is the point. But unless one is in a position to correct them or that, then one should have even tried to avoid that. You know, what would disturb them, you know? Like here. Just like Lord Chaitanya, take prasad, is not a problem. But because it disturbed Ramachandra Puri, therefore he took less. You know, then Ramachandra Puri was very satisfied and all that. So even in that case, he won't, because he wasn't in a position to correct him. Others were not in a position to correct him. So therefore, one adjusts. If it bothers others, okay, one is careful. One is careful, even though it's according to the rules. You know, verse 77. Let him not be uselessly active with his hands or feet, or with his eyes, or crooked in his ways. Or talk idly, nor injure others by deeds, or even think of it. Uselessly active with his hands or feet means you just sit around and do something, piddle with something, throw something, you know, like we sit on the stage and after throwing the akshata and everybody's playing with the akshata, and, you know, you're playing in the ground. Or a place before it mentions you don't pick up dirt clods and break them into powder and plow or weed the fields, then you may break up the dirt clods or pull out the weeds. We just sit there without thinking and pull out grass and break things or draw on the ground or, you know, like it says with his feet, just do funny things and like that. So in other words, he doesn't do useless things. This is one of the activities. This is specifically talking about a Brahmin. Brahmin doesn't waste his time, do weird things that aren't necessary like that. With his hands or his eyes, he should be fixed, listening, doing what he's supposed to be doing, not just looking here, there, doing all kinds of funny things, and watching, and laughing, and all that kind of stuff. Nor crooked in his ways, you know, not straightforward, nor talk idly, just talk the talk, yes.
What about recreation?
What about recreation?
Some people are into it, some people think it's a waste of time.
Some people into recreation, some think it's a waste of time. There's different when there's to approach the subject, because it's a delicate subject, then one has to see many, many things and understand that there's going to be different standards for different natures. The basic standard is Baba said, swimming, wrestling, and I think gardening, these are Vaishnav sports. So these one can do, you know, not excessively to the point of killing oneself or someone else, or so you can't do anything else, you know. We go to the Ganga and the boys come back so stiff, you know. They go to relax to the Ganga and then they come back so stiff, you know, they can't walk, they sleep in the next day, you know, they break their toes and, you know, all this kind of stuff like that. But it was meant for, you know, relaxation and, you know, some enjoyment and like that. So one has to be very, one has to be careful. Is that, see, it's like Brahmins generally don't get much into anything outside of these. We see Lord Chaitanya and his associates, when they get into the water, then they start playing and laughing and joking and all that. But you see the playing, laughing and joking, they splash a little, you know, there's mock kind of fights like this. It's, you know, the wrestling and like this. It's just some light fun. But when one takes the sport very seriously, mm-hmm. and you see, you know, people out there dressed in, you know, high-tech sports gear, and their vocabulary starts becoming reduced down to words that only have four letters in it. And they won't let people play in the game because they know they're not good enough and they may lose. At this time, Maya has fully entrenched herself in the consciousness and hearts, mm-hmm. and in the situation that's going on. Mm-hmm. Because recreation is light. It's only that the mind has been stressed in a particular way, either heavy study, heavy management, heavy something. So then you just do something to just kind of release the mind. And as soon as the mind has been released from that, then the mind is fresh, and then one can do. So there, it's best to find recreations that can do that without any anxiety, without any difficulty. You know, like very common, you know, someone's very stressful day, they'll sit down and, you know, they'll read, they'll chant, they'll sing some bhajans like that, or go for a walk, you know, or sit with friends and discuss, you know, philosophy, or, you know, different activities, light, or, you know, take some prasad, or things like this, swim, you know, wrestle, all these kind of things one can do. And we would see the Kshatriyas, they would do that. They have heavy management, so that's why they would always in the evening, when twilight comes, that's it. Management stops, unless it's an emergency. Management stops, and then they, you know, sit with friends and relatives and eat and, you know, see dramas or hear music or discuss shastras, or all that's just to relieve the mind of the stress. And the next day, then their intelligence is very strong. They can sleep peacefully. Next day, their intelligence is very fixed. Their mind is... Otherwise, if one gets too much of stress, then one can't function at one's best. So the point, recreation can just be just like conversation. It can be so many different things, little things. The Vedic recreations, you see, are very light, you know, splashing in the water and different things, you know, playing with string. Have you ever seen the kids? They have the string and they do this and that and all kinds of things like that. And the most ones I've ever seen are boys from South America.
Yeah,
it's amazing. It's like, you know. So just different little things, just to kind of like, simple thing, engaged in mind. But the best is that one can just divert into a different devotional activity that doesn't either use the body or the mind or that which has been used very severely before that, just to change, to give a change of taste. If that doesn't work, then we may see some material, more mundane activity maybe there. So some light recreation. Prabhupada didn't, like up to the age of 12, I've seen letters where Prabhupada says up to the age of 12, children may play with balls and do different kinds of things like that, but after that he didn't appreciate so much, you know. Though it seems that There was some, they could play some games, because in Vrindavan then they have something. But up to the age of 12, doesn't seem to be a problem. From 12, the brain actually starts working that you can think of philosophy. Before that, not so much. But at 12, a child can seriously start to think about philosophy, goal of life, this and that. It's natural. Mm-hmm. Though maybe not everybody finds that advantage at that age. It may come later, but it can come from that age. Then we see in the original, you know, basically activities, no frivolous sports. Because gambling also in that goes in that category as frivolous sports. It's just wasting your time. You fritter away your time. That's also. So one must see, you know, what's the purpose, you know? Because I've seen, you know, here many times. Yeah, the boys, they play, they get out their football, they play. Someone does something stupid, they all laugh like that, you know. And then when they get the older boys, you know, then somebody does something stupid and then they start like this. And then when the adults run along, somebody does something stupid, then out come the four-letter words and the guy's thrown off the pitch. But it was kind of like, well, hey, wait a minute, isn't this the boys' place to play? What are you guys doing here? You know, what's your goal? Why are you here? Why do you take it so seriously? You know, what is your goal to this game? Like that. And you see, it's just to win. And why? Western conditioning. You know? I've seen it to the point where the school now has just banned the adults from coming like that, you know. I think it cut them down to once a week they could come. Because the adults were too much bad association on the children, you know. Because the adults took the game too seriously. Like that. Well, the children, it was just something to do because they studied all day and they just needed something to kind of like let their mind unwind. But the adults come in and it's like real serious. I mean, it's just like, you know, important. it's like, what do you mean? I mean, the kids know play is not important. They like to do it, but they never say it's important, that this is some dynamic, important activity. No, that's the fun of it. It's a waste of time. Like that. But the adults somehow take it. This is very serious and very important. So at that point, it becomes Maya. Someone has to see what's the mood, what's the outcome, like that. Okay. And if one finds, no, one has to take it that seriously to divert the mind from the other, then one must know that one's nature is very passionate. Because only kings are allowed to. That kind of heavy, heavy recreation, when they may take it more seriously. That means there's a lot of passion. So one should understand that. And then in that, then one should not disturb others, and one should then therefore be very respectful to those who have brahminical activities in nature. One should not try to lord it over them. You know? That. So someone in passion is allowed more freedom in this way, but he's also restricted from trying to control the Brahmins. Like that. Very important. Otherwise, someone with more passion wants to control the whole universe. I mean, look at Hiranyakashipu. It's just natural. You want to control everything, but they're not allowed. So it's just another symptom to understand one's nature. What is one's mind? So those that have that should be respected. I mean, not just you leave them alone, you have to respect. Because they have something that one doesn't have. One may be able to control huge tracts of land or big organizations, but one does not have peace. One does not have less desire. One does not have simplicity. So that has to be respected. One does not have detachment. Right? There's so much attachment to winning the game. It means the detachment is not so strong. It means you don't see when they go out and they just play. They splash water, who wins it doesn't matter. And Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. They may boast this, that, but at the end everybody's just laughing. There's no one. You don't see any roughness, harshness. I mentioned before, no harshness. So in the game there can't be harshness in speaking. Right? Was it? Here. Hatred. want of modesty, pride, anger, harshness. So recreation has to still not go against the rules of proper conduct. So one has to be able to play the games without being harsh, without being anger due to frustration. You know, one can't be, not lose his modesty and not behave properly with somebody. Like we see, yeah. So then, nor injure others by deeds or even think of it. Yeah, one shouldn't even think of injuring others. It's not, because injure others means there's hatred, there's some mysterious desire, someone's done something, you figure they should get some reaction. It's already been said, someone's done something wrong, he's going to get the reaction anyway. It's coming, it's automatic. Okay. So you don't have to worry about it, others are worrying about it. Like that. 178, let him walk in that path of holy men, which his fathers and grandfathers followed. While he walks in that, he will not suffer harm. It says the path of holy men, which his fathers and his grandfathers followed. So if one finds one's fathers and grandfathers didn't follow any bona fide holy men, then we understand the spiritual, the spiritual leaders and those who are able to help us, guide us, you know, teach us, they're the fathers, and then who they're following, and then who are, you know, previous generations of, you know, saintly persons and that, you know, the parampara and like this. Then we follow their example, like that. And if one does that, then there'll be no problems. We'll not suffer harm. Oh, okay. With an officiating or domestic priest, means domestic means someone who is always, if you have activities you want to do, then you always have them do it, like the family priest. You know, because you can all, it means you have one is the Kula Guru, so that's all he does. But then they can also be someone who can give one direction and all that. But basically an officiating means they're called in for a specific function and stuff like that. With a teacher, with a maternal uncle, a guest and a dependent, with infants, aged and sick, men with aged and sick men, with learned men, with his paternal relatives, connections by marriage and maternal, connections by marriage, with his father and mother, with female relatives, with a brother, with his son, with his wife, with his daughter, and with his slaves. Let him not have quarrels. In other words, one should not fight with any of these people. If he avoids quarrels with these persons, he will be freed from all sins, and by suppressing all such quarrels, a householder conquers all the following worlds. The world of Brahman. The father has power over the world of the Lord of created beings, Prajapati. A guest rules over the world of Indra, and the priests over the world of the gods. The female relatives have power over the world of the apsaras, the maternal relatives over that of the Vishvadevas, the connections by marriage over that of the waters, the mother and maternal uncle over the earth. Infants, aged, poor, and sick men must be considered as rulers of the middle sphere, the antariksha. The eldest brother as equal to one's father, so that's Prajapati. One's wife and one's son as one's own body. One's dependents as one's shadow. One's daughter as the highest object of tenderness. Hence, if one is offended by any of these, one must bear it without resentment. Then all these things have been, you know, conquered. One, in other words, one develops the qualities of that realm. And if one doesn't, then one will not gain those qualities. So here's one, interesting point here is one's daughter is the highest object of tenderness. The father is always very kind to the daughter. Very, very kind. You know, the mother to the son, the father to the daughter. And that, because, yeah. is a very... So here we have... Here's the Shastrit. I've been saying this for years, so here's the quote. It says, one must bear it without resentment. So all these different things, if a quarrel comes out, one just has to let it go. Right? So that officiating domestic priest with a teacher, maternal uncle, a guest, a dependent, with infants, small children, aged and sick men, with learned men, with his paternal relatives, connections by marriage, and maternal relatives. What does that mean?
Maternal?
Maternal relatives and connections by marriage. Oh, maternal means amongst mother's relatives. Mm-hmm. And then there's the ones by marriage. What's happening?
Lights.
Oh, what time is it now?
10:06.
Oh, yeah, you can take it. We can handle it. Either that or we can go inside. Okay. Then, mother, father, female relatives, brother, son and wife, daughter with his dependents, let him not have quarrels. So, these are the people one should not quarrel with. It doesn't say here. Doesn't say business partners.
So it's for Brahmins?
Yes. Yeah, this is the Brahmins. And it's just these are all people who are close. Because if peaceful in this front, then that whole side goes very peaceful, nicely. But if one doesn't, then it becomes too harsh. Especially Brahman has very great difficulty living in that world, like that. So unless one has come to the point of detachment, but if he's detached, he won't argue anyway. So if the ability to argue is there, then the attachment is still there, and then that means he needs to go through all this. This particular aspects of the ashram, because then that will then relieve him of those attachments as he progresses in this. Uh, 186. Though by his learning and sanctity he may be entitled to accept presents, let him not attach himself too much to that habit. For though his accepting many presents, the divine light in him is soon extinguished. So this means that due to the brahminical qualities here, the purity, the knowledge he has, the holiness that is there, then one may be, people may offer gifts, but he should not become habituated to that. In other words, he expects that this is how he's going to, maintain himself and become very attached to these things. It means he understands. He just accepts what the Lord sends. But that's just accepting what's sent. He's not attached to the idea. Mm-hmm. Habituated to the idea someone comes, they must give you something. Mm-hmm. They must respect me. I'm a great personality. Why he's not giving? Why he only gave that much? Mm-hmm. That's all he gave. That kind of thing. That must be avoided. Because otherwise, then it says here that the divine light in him is soon extinguished. Because then one becomes materialistic. One wants the fruits of one's knowledge and purity. But a Brahman is supposed to be detached from these things. He's supposed to be his endeavor. Is for purification. You can only purify yourself if you perform activities without attachment. So he should not be looking like this, like Raghunath Das. Then he was sitting at. Without a full knowledge of the rules, 187. Without a full knowledge of the rules prescribed by the sacred law for the acceptance of presents, a wise man should not take anything, even though he may pine with hunger. But an ignorant man who accepts gold, land, a horse, a cow, food, a dress, sesame grains, or clarified butter is reduced to ashes like a piece of wood. Gold and food destroy his longevity. Land and a cow his body, a horse his eyesight, a garment his skin, clarified butter his energy, sesame grains his offspring. It's interesting. Sesame carries the most karma of any grain. A Brahman who neither performs austerities nor studies the Veda, yet delights in accepting gifts, sinks with the donor into hell, just as he who attempts to cross over it, over in a boat made of stone, is submerged in the water. Hence, an ignorant man should be afraid of accepting any presents, for by reason of a very small gift, even a fool sinks into hell, as a cow into a morass. A man who knows the law should not offer even water to a Brahmin who acts like a cat, nor to a Brahmin who acts like a heron, nor to one who is unacquainted with the Veda. For property, though earned in accordance with prescribed rules, which is given to these three persons, causes in the next world misery both to the giver and the recipient.
What
is
the Brahmin who
acts like a cat or heron? I'm trying to see here. Well, the heron, I think, is the, I think, comes back to sometimes they give the yogis. They seem very self-controlled and everything like this, and put on a big front of great controlled, you know, yogis. But then, as soon as some sense gratification in the form of a little fish goes by, immediately they jump and grab it. So it's probably just imposters who put on the airs of being very advanced and everything like that. Cat, I'm not sure.
Bird is a heron.
I don't know exactly sure in the English word, but
heron, those ones that stood out in there with the white.
I think they're the only bird that the fish can kill even if they are not hungry.
Huh?
Even if they are not hungry, they fish and kill the fishes.
But just for just like that. Some fun, you know. Yeah, because it mentions here is that they move through the water as if they're being very careful not to disturb anybody. Mm-hmm. As soon as they find somebody they can take advantage of, and they do it. Like that. For property, though, as he who attempts to cross water in a boat of stone sinks to the bottom, even so ignorant donor and an ignorant donee sink low. So this is the aspect of that one get something, we receive something, but for the brahmana, one of his activities is he used to give in charity. He acquires more than what he needs, he must give in charity. So that charity must be given to someone who's qualified. You can't just give it to anybody, because that's a waste. You know, someone has received. The Kshatriya has received money, the Brahmins received money, the Vaishyas received money by performance of their prescribed duties. These prescribed duties are given by God, and the result is given by God. So it actually belongs to God and should be used for proper directions according to the law of God. So now, if someone doesn't, how do you say? So if we just give to anybody, then that means that there'll be, how do you say? is happy. They ask him about the possibility of doing recording, because the boys will be gone, so Madanga teacher will be free.
Bhagavad Gita talks about charity and the different modes of nature.
Yeah, yeah. Bhagavad Gita also, yeah.
Given to an unqualified person.
Yeah, mode of ignorance, yeah. Or grudgingly.
Grudgingly.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you give away something that you don't want, you don't like.
You don't want, yeah.
But you make a big error.
Yeah, that you're being very kind. No, if you find things you don't need, because you have too much, then those things can be given away. But you still have the responsibility, because this actually belongs to Krishna. And he's given it to you. Doesn't mean that you have to keep it. It means now it's your responsibility to see that it's given to someone who will use it properly. Like that. So it must be given to qualified persons. So even giving in charity is a responsibility. And then for the Brahmin, he can accept charity. Like that. So this is... A man who over covetous displays the flag of virtue, who is a hypocrite, a deceiver of the people, intent on doing injury, and a detractor from the merits of all men. One must know to be one who acts like a cat. Okay, here's the definition. A man who is ever covetous displays the flag of virtue, who is a hypocrite, a deceiver of the people, intent on doing injury, and a detractor from the merits of all men, one must know to be one who acts like a cat. So one can also understand that this is the mentality of a cat, meaning this nice, cute, little fuzzy thing that purrs when you touch it. But this is actually the mentality. Just that we're bigger than them, so they don't, you know, cut us up in little pieces and eat us, you know, and that's all.
Panchatantra tells the story of two birds got a fish, and they're arguing. No, it's mine, no, it's mine, no, it's mine. So then the cat comes along dressed like a sadhu. Says, why are you fighting my brothers? And they say, cats always chase birds and eat them. They also like to eat fish. They say, you know, this is my fish. No, I saw it. No, I got it. Whatever. You dropped it. No, I got it. Says, brothers, please don't fight. This is not good. This is not becoming. Let me divide the fish for you. So he takes, he says, I'll be very, very careful, very fair, very careful. Takes the knife and he cuts off the head and he cuts off the tail. He says, the head is for you, the tail is for you. And because I'm mediating, then I'll take the center. So that the head's unedible, the tail's unedible. The only edible bit is the center. Then he walks away with that.
Then that Brahman who with downcast look of a cruel disposition is solely intent on attaining his own ends, dishonest and falsely gentle, one who is one who acts like a heron. Those Brahmanas who act like herons and those who display the characteristics of cats fall in consequence of that wicked mode of acting into the hell called Andhatamistra. When he has committed a sin, let him not perform a penance under the pretense that the act is intended to gain spiritual merit, thus hiding his sin under the pretext of a vow and deceiving women and shudras. When one's done something wrong, one must atone for that. He does that, but he presents it as it's his own decision for a great spiritual act. And then others will think, oh, such a, you know, advanced personality, so austere, like that. Such brahmanas are reprehended after death and in this life by those who expound the Veda, and a vow performed under false pretense goes to the Rakshasas. So the benefits of that vow go to the Rakshasas, so he never actually becomes purified by that penance. It's simply a show. So Krishna is very kind and gives everybody in the universe their opportunity to get their benefits. You know, because he's the Lord of all creatures, so he gives everybody an opportunity. So the Rakshasas, then they get their benefit of penances and austerities and prayaschittas if they're done by people, you know, in this hidden, deceitful way. Then they get the benefits, you know. So the rakshasas don't mind. 200. He who, without being a student, gains his livelihood by wearing the dress of a student, takes upon himself the guilt of all students, and is born again in the womb of an animal. So someone who dresses up as a brahmachari and then goes out and does those activities and all that, you know, then and then maintains himself, you know, by begging in that way, then that's then he says he gets the guilt of all students. So the what do you call it? The bad activities of all students go to him. Because the Vedas, it mentions something one way, is that you can't harm a Brahman, you have to respect a Brahman and all that, but we see then it also describes what is a Brahman. And someone who doesn't act like one, then you can't give charity to him, you can't do so many things, you know. It's just one avoids this situation. It's a very interesting. The Vedas are in no way not balanced. They're very balanced on these kind of things. But, let him never bathe in tanks belonging to other men. If he bathes in such a one, he is tainted by a portion of the guilt of him who made the tank. In other words, the sinful reactions and all that to come that are there in the person who's built the tank. If you go and bathe in someone else's, means this is, we're talking about, you know, married persons. Brahmachari, sannyasi, that's another thing. With permission, they go. As a friend, relative, that's another thing. But just to go and use someone else's facilities like that, then it's not proper, you know. Because, you know, grihastha is supposed to be able to, yeah. He doesn't live in this way. You know, he has to move in realms that are known, you know, people who he knows, you know, situations that are where the whole relationships and everything are understood. So it's just like the king. If he takes tax but doesn't protect the people, then instead of getting only as much reaction of the citizens, the sins of the citizens, as he's taken tax. He takes 25% tax, he takes 25% of their sins. But if he takes the tax but doesn't protect the people, he gets 100% of their sins. Like that. So you can't get away with anything. The Vedas don't allow. Like that. Yes. Can you speak loudly?
It's kind of simple question. But, you know, like, let's say if kings take 100% of the sins, then you see that the citizens still go to hell. So, you know.
The citizens still go to hell?
Yeah.
Why would the citizens go to hell? The citizens have been relieved of their sins. Why would they go to hell?
So they don't go to hell.
No.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, they suffer in you know, hell here, because if you don't have a king that protects you, then you're already suffering the reactions of your sins. Already a hellish environment. He who uses without permission a carriage, a bed, a seat, a well, a garden, or a house belonging to another man takes upon himself 1/4 of the owner's guilt. I think here always guilt means karma. You know? I always find it amusing that there's this big, you know, dramatic conversation about who's taking the karma of the disciple. And it basically boils down to only a nitya siddha can do that. But we see just in the day-to-day activities, you know, the parents are taking for the children, husband for wife, the king for the citizens, you know, the teacher for the students. You know, here just you go out and just use someone else's things without asking, you get 1/4 of their karma. So it doesn't seem to be a big thing, but somehow or another that's been made the big thing, you know. It's just like the ritual of the lamp, you know. In India you take the lamp and you start at the front and you go through until you get to the back. But then you get the ritual of the lamp, is where the lamp comes out, and then, you know, you have to judge everybody in the room, who's more senior, less senior, and each one, this one, and going to this one, and zigzagging over to that one, and then when you go to the next one, someone tries to get the lamp, you push your hand out of the way, and then turns out, because you've made a ritual out of something that is very simple. So the thing is karma is gained in a very simple way, and it can also be distributed in very simple ways. But that becomes a very major thing, because, you know, for Westerners especially, karma is a very new concept. It's a very big thing. But, you know, it's like in the sixth canto, when it's talking about Ajamiyo, Prabhupada, one of the purports, talks about the paltry amount of sins of the universe. There's all the sins of the universe, some paltry amount, compared to the power of the holy name, because the discussions is about the power of the holy name as opposed to prayaschitya. Prayaschitya anyway can only get rid of one quarter of the sin. Like that. The holy name can get rid of everything. So it's called, Prabhupada refers to as a paltry amount of sin, but somehow or another sin, reaction, karma, you know, becomes a very major, major discussion, which I just find very amusing. You know, especially when you go through this and find out, you know, you just, you know, when someone touches your feet, you accept karma. Everybody will understand that, you know. Or you give food to someone else, that karma goes to the person who eats it. But somehow or another, only a nitya-siddha can take your karma. Right? You can give it to someone else by touching their feet. But when it comes to initiation, only the nitya-siddha can do. Therefore, who takes the karma? That's like major decision. If you just say, well, everybody takes, you know, this that simple. Oh, no, we have to put this into research. Because it's such a big topic. No, you just answered it in, you know, 2 seconds. No, but, you know, it's, okay.
Nitya-siddhas take the karma in other cases, or initiation, the banana takes the karma.
Yeah, sometimes the banana also takes the karma, right? Throw the banana in the fire.
No, you can't eat that. That's got the karma. I said, the banana didn't take the karma, the guru took the karma.
I said, don't eat the guru. He's got the karma. Yeah, banana you can eat, don't eat the guru. He's got all the karma.
That's a quick initiation from the banana.
Yes, yes. The banana, you've opened your... Is it? Om Ajnana Timirandasya. Is it? Bananjana Chalakaya.
Maybe not be
with the shalaka of banana, remove the ignorance.
He's not nitya-siddha, he's kola-siddha.
He's kola-siddha, yes. And there's also then alu-siddha. Yes, the great siddha. Alu-siddha. Okay. Then, let him always bathe in rivers, in ponds, dug by the gods themselves, in lakes and in water holes or springs. In other words, natural things or tanks, sacred places, like that. In other words, if you want to go, like we're here, instead of going to someone's, he has a nice bathing tank and it's private and wonderful, you don't go there. You go down to the Ganga and bathe there. Go up to, you know, Jalungi is there. Preetu dug the one at Yogput Pit. Someone else dug the one at Bamanpukur. I mean, there's plenty things that, you know, natural rivers, springs, creeks, you know, just things that have been created by either created by the material nature has created them, the Lord has created them, the different great personalities have created them. Those ones, those are for everybody, because you become sanctified by those, purified. But going and using someone else's private thing, that's not good. Okay. The wise man should constantly discharge the paramount duties called yama, but not always the minor ones called niyama. For he who does not discharge the former while he obeys the latter alone becomes an outcast. So if one, in other words, if the principle is not followed, but the details are very stuck to, then there's not going to be much benefit. Because that means one doesn't actually understand the process, what's going on. So this is what I mean. You get stuck with these little things like that. But that's not the main thing. But the whole thing is, who gets the karma? No. What am I? Is that the whole relation with the guru? Just I dump my karma? No. Is that you go and you gain that knowledge by which we can destroy ignorance and go back to Godhead. Ignorance is we think we're separate from the Lord. So that is the value. I mean, if we get caught up with who is the ignorance and, you know, how many nanometers high can be the asana they sit on, or, you know, can we wash the feet, or, okay, we can only wash, okay, you can wash the big toe, you know, or only 1 foot at a time, or, you know, only the bottom of the feet.
Once a year.
Yeah, once a year. Or, you know, I mean, it's like these are, to get sidetracked in this way is not good. Because it says one becomes an outcast. How do you become an outcast? Because you're accepting the external points of culture without understanding the philosophy behind it. You know? So following the philosophy without the culture without the philosophy, both are bad. They both have to be there. Okay, what time is it now?
6:45.
Yeah, I think we'll be on. Is there any other questions on this? Yes.
Related to that karma, I'm talking with
my... Related to the karma.
Yeah, talking with my devotee, he was asking me that, you know, when there is...
Speak loudly.
I was talking with my devotee in Vrindavan, and he was asking me that, you know, when you take initiation, then the guru is supposed to take karma. So he was saying, from his own experience, he had asthma before he took initiation, and after initiation, he
still has asthma.
Yeah.
So he wants to know why his guru didn't get the asthma. I see. Yeah, no, that's definitely an important reason for taking initiation. That it had suffered with this asthma so long. Finally, I found a guru who is going to accept me, and now he will get the asthma. No, Krishna takes away, he doesn't take away the prarabdha karma. Because the prarabdha karma is what keeps us in touch with the reality of the situation. See, it's because of the prarabdha karma, then we're in anxiety. Due to lack of wealth, due to anxiety, you know, just in general, due to, you know, lack of knowledge and wanting that. So we surrender to the Lord. So now if Krishna takes that away, then what's to keep us from being forgetful like the demigods? They're enjoying very nicely. They don't remember the Lord for one second. Right? Only when some calamity comes, then generally they remember. Right? They just don't remember. So that's why the prarabdha remains. Because if you remove all of the karma, I mean just right down to zero karma left, wouldn't that be good? Remove all the karma, right? Everything. So then, what are you going to do about your body? Because the body is a result of karma. That means you'll be a ghost. If you remove all your prarabdha karma, then you'll just be a subtle body.
You go back to Godhead straight away?
No, you wouldn't go back because you still have the material. You still have the material desires. You know, you still have the subtle body to work it out. And you can only go back if you have love for Krishna. Even we say, okay, it gets rid of all the desires because devotional service destroys the desires. So it liberates one. But liberation just means you're on the Brahman platform. Right? So one has to make the choice to go back to Godhead. So the prarabdha karma is to remind us of that.
What is the prarabdha karma?
Prarabdha karma is the result, the fruit. See, you have four stages of karma. There is the desire seed. You have a desire. I want this. It plants that's the seed. Then, since one has that, one works for it, then it sprouts. That's the second stage. So that means now the desire, now the machinery, the mechanics of it, the material nature is creating the result. Then you have the next stage is Phulan Mukha. Means it's about ready to. It's like the plant. It's grown. Everything's there. It's ready to give the fruit. It's like the bud is there. So everything's ready. Like that. And then the Prarabdha is the actual fruit itself. So devotional service will destroy all those first three. Prayaschitya can destroy part of the Prarabdha. Or it can get rid of the Prarabdha, but it leaves the other three. So you're going to do it again. Because the desire is there, one's going to perform improper activities again. That's why devotional service is more powerful. Because it destroys the seed.
Rastapayeshu abhadreshu nityam bhagavati
sevaya
bhagavati utamashyata. Says that all that is rastapayeshu abhadreshu, abhadra, inauspicious, is almost completely destroyed to me.
Almost completely destroyed, yeah.
Because the Prarabdha remains.
Yeah, because the Prarabdha is very small. Like, that's the small point. Right. To manage that is to create everything else. That's pretty like big. Yeah. Is this on the same point or a different point?
Because also, you know, by the grace of Guru, somebody become free from bodily concept of life. So it's actually free from time now.
Yeah, but the body still remains. Mm-hmm. So at least enough Prarabdha karma is there for the body, and enough to remind us that the body, you know, the material world is a place of misery. Because even if we go beyond that, one doesn't notice the body anyway. So it's only a disturbance because of our attachment to it. Yes, Master?
Maharaj, when you were talking earlier about the Brahmana not dealing harshly, and not chastising those outside of his own shelter, there is a saying, you can't move a buffalo with a peacock thing. So some that we have to work with or deal with, they actually need that push. So is it more the mentality of the activity rather than the activity that's important?
The mentality, yeah, mentality of the activity is very important. Because it may be one has to say something quite straight in that, or deal in a very, you know, strong way, but it can't be harsh. It must be suitable to the situation where it just gets done what needs to be done. You know? I mean, like you can take a peacock feather and move a mosquito, you know? And you take that and push the buffalo, nothing happens. So you may have to get out a stick, and then you wave that around and the buffalo understands. Or even he doesn't understand that, then you give him a poke, he understands, but you still are not creating any harm to the buffalo. You know, if you create harm to the buffalo in getting him to move, then that's improper. In other words, it must be balanced with what one is dealing. You know, just like, you know, when you meet a Punjabi, then they'll slap you on your back, you know, and it puts your shoulder blade out of place for 3 weeks. So, you know, that's just normal for them. You know, so a good slap on the back, and then, you know, but you do that to a Bengali, you know, you might kill him, you know. So it's one has to also, that's there, the environment in which you're working. But it should never be perceived as harsh or nasty. You know? People, like street people, you talk in their language and they think, okay, this person means business, or they're okay, or they're clever. They don't take it you're being harsh, but if you use the street language on somebody who's gentle, then it will be taken very badly.
Later on it will come that a Shudra who shouts the Brahmin 2 times is deserved to be killed and should be killed.
The same thing. Same point?
No, you're going to make a point about karma.
Oh.
Is that all right?
Yeah, yeah, no, because I think you have something about the karma also. Yeah.
Just in terms of taking of karma, initiation, isn't that related to surrender also?
Yes. That's the same. That's why that's the aspect of the student to the teacher, the children to the parents, the wife to the husband, the citizens to the king. Because it's the rasa. In other words, the parental rasa, because for welfare for the other person, you take their difficulties. You take on their problems like that. And you are responsible to see that they're trained properly, that they are guided properly, that they act properly. Like parents, I've seen parents, the three-year-old child goes up to devotees and says all kinds of bad things and does crazy things, and everybody, I've seen the parents and other friends of the parents just sit around and laugh, you know, oh, it's a little kid, you know, it's nothing serious. But the point is devotees have been offended. And so then it's a little kid, you can't punish a little kid as such. You know, the parents can correct, but otherwise there's no punishment with a little kid. But what the parents don't understand is that offense of against the devotee goes to the parents and it affects their devotional life. When that kid becomes 16, then it stays with them. They're adults. But up to 16, it goes to the parents. Unless they put them in a gurukul and they're under a teacher, then it will go to the teacher. Like that. So that has to be, it's not understood. It's taken very cheaply. Though, when it comes to spiritual, it's taken very seriously. Then let's come to the other things. Oh, that's fanatic. We just chant Hare Krishna. We don't care. So then we just chant Hare Krishna. Who cares where the karma goes? No, but that only nitya sitting like this. It's very amazing combination of how do you say, logic. Does that answer the question? Yeah.
There was some discussion earlier in the year about whether why it is that someone who appears to be a very advanced devotee may fall down. And one of the reasons that was proposed was that due to this parabdha karma, it causes them to fall down even though they may have no other fault. Didn't seem to make sense.
No, it can. If one takes unqualified students, that's why it's an offense to the holy name to take the ninth offense where it says don't preach to the faithless. That's the external, I mean that's not the external, but that's the point of where you're preaching somebody. The other side of it is don't accept unqualified disciples. So if you accept unqualified disciples, then you get so much reaction from them, and then that may overburden one's own devotional potency. So that is an aspect, don't bother with problems.
So that means in terms of accepting the reactions from disciples?
Yeah, no, that's an aspect, so one has to be very careful. That's why one just sees the disciples are very qualified. Mm-hmm. Just accepting out of sentiment, you know, like they come to you and say, oh, if you don't give me initiation, then I'm going to bloop and go out and start shooting heroin. No, don't do that. You know, it's like, you know, I thought one is supposed to approach to be spiritual master because one wants to go back to Godhead. that should be a positive, you know. There must be pranipata, pariprasna, and seva, like that. So if that's all that is, initiation is one micrometer above taking heroin. You know, taking heroin's okay, but a little bit better than that's taking initiation. So if I can get the initiation, okay, then I won't take the heroin. I mean that doesn't. That kind of compassion is not recommended. One can do it if one is very powerful, but generally one has to be very careful. One can give association, but it's not recommended to give initiation. So that is there. One has to be very careful.
I think the argument was more whether it's like the karma of the person himself, you know, regardless of the disciples. So, you know, he may be an advanced devotee, supposing he didn't have disciples, that it was his, you know, some reactions for something he's done previous to his devotional service. That's,
it can be reactions previous, it can also be reactions during service. Offenses to devotees, you know, can disturb anybody. That's why the advanced devotees are so careful, and that's why they remain advanced, because they are careful. So if someone advances but is not careful, then with time he'll have difficulty in maintaining that advanced position. The mistake many times is thought that they were never advanced. You know, it's either all or nothing. But then what's the meaning of sadhana siddha, kripa siddha, archana siddha? Is through a process you advance. Right? So if it's like, today I'm a crazy materialist, and then the next day I surrender to the process, and so that means that day then I must become a pure unalloyed devotee, then okay, then we can use this. But if there's some very gradation in between, that means that someone can advance, that means they've advanced, but there still will be some amount of material contamination. But because it's just like the moon has spots on it, but do we talk about the spots? No, because we look at the shine, its beauty, its coolingness, its illumination. That's the one that a honest person looks at. Any fool can appreciate, can look at the spots on the moon. But it takes someone with a little character to appreciate the fine points of the illumination and the beauty and all this kind of aspects. Like that. So one has to, one sees that. So if one has done some nice service, that is appreciated. Someone can go, wow, he went out and he did the best in Sankirtan today and distributed so many books and all that. So we could look at that and go, wow, that's great. Or we could go, well, he also has so many material desires, and I saw him down at the corner, eating some, carmi peanuts and all that, and he did, he left his socks in the corner over there and like that, and I saw him, he ate 10 chapatis, like that. We could do that also. But Prabhupada says that when someone's in the shower, the honest person knows this person is becoming clean. So one looks at that side of it. It's just a matter of time and they'll be very clean. A dishonest person, goes there and, oh, he's in the shower, but, he's still got some dirt on his back, and look at the stuff on his knees and behind the ears. No, he's doing the process of cleaning. He's scrubbing himself. So why wouldn't one even waste the energy to look for dirty places unless it is your business to help them get clean? They don't know how to clean and you're telling them. Like the mother tells the child, wash behind your ears. Like that. But if that's not your position, why would one even waste time? This is idle talk. A Brahmin doesn't do that. This is idle, useless, idle talk. Because what has it got to do with reality? They're following the process that will get rid of all that. So unless it's your duty to help them in that, it's a waste of time. Absolute waste of time. Devotees like to sit around and talk about, this one fell down, and this one this, and he did this, and he did that. Absolute 101% waste of time. Because we are not in a position to help the person, and our approach to the topic is not how we can see that we don't fall in the same difficulties. So it's just idle talk. Even if it's about devotees, it's about, improper things in devotional service, it's still 100% prajalpa. It's not that because we're talking about devotees, therefore it's not. It's still prajalpa. Unless somebody is benefiting, the person you're talking about is benefiting, or the people who are speaking about it or hearing it are benefiting by someone did this, and then because of that, then they fell down. So we have to be very careful to avoid these kind of things. Then there's some benefit. But if you just said, this one did this and that one did that, and did you hear this, and what's the latest? That's all useless talk. It will neither benefit, no one will become benefited. And the atmosphere will become polluted. There's no benefit. And one can't bring any shastric evidence or example by the acharyas that it is beneficial. It has no benefit. If one can give as an example based on a shastric point, then that has benefit. Right? So that the service can go better. You're dealing with people who that is their area. or they have some connection to that example, and they can benefit, then there's great benefit by talking about it. But just to talk, you know, is something to just pass the time, or, you know, to get the emotions going or the bile going, or to make your life, you know, fruitful by creating an issue for yourself because you can't actually get into the devotional process. So you get yourself into an issue, so then you feel that you're doing something in life. Like that.
In this particular case, there was like a discussion going on, as you said. We were looking at someone who fell down and thinking, we were trying to figure out what the reasons were, you know, what can we learn from this that we can avoid. And some were proposing the argument that actually that person didn't do anything wrong at all, but it's just their karma from before they become a devotee.
It's just the karma before you become a devotee that you fall down.
It seems to me that if you're actually following properly, then even if you have karma, that the devotional service will overcome that. Yeah. Unless there's some fault in the devotional service.
Do you have something on that, Matthew?
I think, that if you have concept that fall down, it's a little bit narrow. But if we look at Bhagavatam, it's an evolutionary process.
Yeah.
And in Bhagavatam we find two great souls who go through incredible difficulty and embarrassment, but it's part of their evolution to Dhamma.
Yeah.
So if you look at things from the Bhagavatam perspective, the other way you can do it, I also like to do, is to just show it